Ah, the joy, the thrill resulting from the flooding, the beauty that has resulted in Lake Eyre, and of course the tragedy with the ABC losing Paul and Gary and John in that heartbreaking helicopter accident. And there's now another very significant event about to occur there, and oddly, very little has been said or at least reported about it. In 2 weeks' time, the Arrabunna people of South Australia will be formally recognised as the native title owners of Lake Eyre, and a huge slab of land around it, one-fifth of South Australia, I'm told. On May 22, there will be an on-site legal hearing and a judgment presided over by Federal Court Judge Paul Finn, and it sounds like there might be a pretty good party afterwards. And just by the way, possibly a name change for the lake. Aaron Stewart is the chairperson of Uluraka Arrabunna Association. He's busy preparing for this event, and I'm delighted he's able to join us from his office in Port Augusta. G'day, Aaron.
Yes, good evening. How are you?
Stephen Kenny is the association's lawyer. He's been handling the native title claim, and he's also known to the listener as David Hicks' lawyer. And Stephen joins us from his home in Adelaide. Welcome. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thank you, Philip.
And Peter Elphis is a photographer receiving critical acclaim for his deeply moving aerial photos of the lake area in flood. And somehow they speak of something even deeper than landscape. There are two simultaneous exhibitions of his work in Sydney. But Peter, you can't wait to get back to South Australia for the ceremony.
Oh, no, I can't. Thanks for getting me on, Philip. And it's very exciting times for all on Saturday.
Aaron, tell us who else will be coming to this momentous day on the 22nd.
At this stage, we've got about 688 Arrabunna registered members. People from that have been assimilated in the early days that were transferred to the actual consent determination is on Finniss Springs Station. So that's an old cattle station, but within there was a lease to the UMA missions where a lot of the Aboriginal people from the desert were sent back in the early days. So coming to this event, obviously the station hasn't been at work, or the mission had closed down about 30 years ago, and so people who were born there will be returning, and there's a lot of memories, historical. So yeah, when we've also invited other guests to just come along and enjoy the festivities.
And so this is sort of a welcome mat, limited only by logistics, for anyone who wants to share in the spirit of the native title.
Yes, that's correct, but it will be a very spiritual event, because obviously with a lot of the stolen generation, that's that type of stuff that affects native title, and where people are assimilated. Well, a lot of the people that are coming also, we're expecting people who are not Arrabunna to also attend, because they were assimilated there, and then obviously due to health conditions and any other social factors, they've gone and moved into cities, so we're expecting them back there also.
Stephen Kenny, you've been on this case for a long time, because it was 14 years since you logged a claim on behalf of the Arrabunna people.
Yes, that's right. It was a very long time ago, and as you would appreciate, in the early days of native title, it was a fairly hostile environment as well. The Howard government and their then opposition, and their opposition to it was quite significant, and native title was seen as a very divisive thing.
And there was also, let's face it, opposition, or at least massive disinterest within the Labor governments.
Yes, there was.
It took Keating to shake that loose.
Well, they needed to do something. I mean, the Mabo case was a long time coming in Australia. I mean, for your listeners, they may not realise, they may think native title is a recent invention, but in fact, First Peoples in America were granted and ran native title cases over 150 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just that we were well behind the times.
Well, Stephen, this hearing that we've been talking about will be non-contested. The Arrabunna, with anthropologist Anne New, completed a land to culture, a connection report that went to the state government, and the government accepted that you'd win if it went to contested trial.
Yes, that's essentially what happened. It was a great It was actually quite a fascinating thing to do, because it involved going out onto the country with Aaron, amongst others, and other elders of the group, and talking about their ongoing spiritual connection to country. And, you know, for a white Australian, it's an incredible privilege to have that closeness to country demonstrated in the way that these people did. I have, you know, no doubt that if we had gone to a contested hearing, that they would have won that hearing based on a number of key people who've remained there all their lives and have maintained their connection to that country.
Stephen, who tried to throw a spanner in the works? Was there some recalcitrance from the mining companies?
No, funnily enough, the mining companies, I think, have generally factored in native title these days into their calculations, and we've not had any difficulty with the mining companies. I mean, in the early days, it was a major issue with Western Mining up there, and there is an issue at the moment with BHP and the amount of water they draw out of the Artesian Basin to run their Olympic Dam mine. For the Arabunna, there are what we call mound springs, which are artesian springs, that are being affected by the amount of water that's being taken out, or at least they believe it's that, and I can't prove or disprove it one way or another. But generally, the mining companies have been excellent to work with.
I'm delighted to hear it. Now, Aaron, your sense of timing is impeccable, because near next month marks the 20th anniversary of the Mabo decision. So, your timing is exquisite.
Yes, and if I could just make comment too, since 14 years ago when the native title had gone in, obviously we've lost a lot of family members, that were around elders, and every time we lose elders or we lose someone that's attached to land, you know, it really affects us. So this event up at Finniss is going to be also very emotional.
Well, looking at the spirituality of the area, yeah. I understand that you're already trying to sort of pull back inappropriate use of the lake. I understand that your association has stopped speedboats thundering around.
At this stage, we don't like any boating on the lake. To us, the lake is very spiritual. We think the lake is beautiful, both wet and dry. It mightn't be Kakadu, it mightn't be the Great Barrier Reef, but it is significant for the with many heritage stories connected to it.
Yeah.
But it is sacred to us. But we do open our arms to tourists visiting. We just don't like boating on the lake. If I could just mention whether you said about the Mabo decision. One thing with the Arabunna, and I was thinking about this morning when I spoke to one of your reporters who rang, when Kevin Rudd apologised, and a lot of the community, non-Aboriginal community, you know, and there was a question about compensation. To me, as the Arabunna chairman and with my people, I believe native title, whether it's what we want, it's what we got, but I believe with part of the package, and Stephen might be able to comment a bit more, is the state is actually giving us our native title, but also a pastoral lease property for so many X amount of years, many years, which also benefits our people. So what I'm trying to say there is that it's good to see federal and state government working on together with this and actually working with an Aboriginal group and then giving them this parcel land also on top of your native title to do your cultural festivities or, you know, your climate change adaptation plans on there to work in with the rest of the community. I just think it's great, yeah.
Stephen, let's look at name changing. I well remember the resentment and kerfuffle when Ayers Rock became Uluru. Will there be a similar anger or irritation about Lake Eyre morphing into another name?
I would hope not. I think the Uluru decision was, in advance of this, and people now realise that, of course, the people who live there had names for everything. I mean, the Arabunna, for example, take their name from what we call the Sturt's Desert Pea. And so I think Lake Eyre, I mean, who was, what right have we got to sort of waltz in there and give a place a name that already had one? And,
I remember we did a program, a series of programs going down the Murray. And not only could nobody tell me who the hell Murray was, but I discovered the river had a dozen names, you know, local names, as we as we followed its contours. Beautiful, beautiful and ancient names. So what name is being proposed, Stephen?
Kati Thunka is the name, if I, Aaron, well, forgive me if I've pronounced it wrongly. And the lake itself, I mean, what people, you know, perhaps as you learnt in travelling down the Murray, the creation stories of those places are, you know, interesting and detailed and complex in their own right, and certainly with the Arabunna. I mean, they are clearly the native title owners of the lake because of their knowledge of the creation of the lake, and their stories of it are quite fascinating.
Okay, let's bring Peter Elvis. He's been sitting here patiently. Let's bring him into the conversation. Peter, would you please read the document that you just thrust at me, because it expresses your feelings, I think, pretty succinctly.
Thank you. It does. For me, it's very important to recognise the traditional owners, and I, for one, have been calling that L place, I don't even use that word anymore, Kati Thunderer for many months, and all the literature and information panels at Customs House, which is in Circular Quay in Sydney, and sees 100,000 people visiting a month to my exhibition, which has been going since February and has been extended to the end of July. See the panels using that word, not the other word, which I'm happy about. What I wrote down when I was sitting out in the lounge is to the colonial explorers, this place was considered a desolate and empty salt pan. It is in fact a place rich with life of all kinds, with flowing creeks, mound springs. The lakes and the surrounding desert have a profound and spiritual significance to the indigenous people there. Underneath the desert sands lie the deep veins of the Uluraka and Arabunna people and thousands of years of their cultural heritage.
Well, it's interestingly, the spirituality that Aaron talks about touched you and changed your life. You were on the verge of chucking photography, weren't you?
Totally.
You were bored with it. You were sick of, doing special events and stuff around Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And then this hit you.
Yes, it did. And you're right. It was profound. A place that changes the way you see the country only comes along once in a lifetime. And you can ignore it. I mean, a lot of photographers travel around the country and never use the traditional names for places and don't recognise traditional owners and just look at it from a commercial gain. To me, it's like running into a supermarket, emptying the shelves and just waving your arms at the checkout and saying, cheers, thanks a lot, and clearing off. I think morally it's not correct, and I think that reconciliation is a responsibility of every individual in the country, not just the Commonwealth government or state government, and especially people who make commercial gains from places that are traditional lands of Aboriginal people.
Peter, remind the listener where we are geographically. What else is nearby? We've got the Birdsville Track. Do a sat nav for me.
Yeah, the lake is in the between Birdsville and Williams Creek. Birdsville is on obviously the Birdsville Track, which runs all the way down to a place called Maori. It's about 600 kilometres, and at Maori, the junction is the Udnadatta Track. If you take the Udnadatta north, you're heading towards Alice Springs, and you'll reach William Creek. And above Lake Eyre, of course, is the Simpson Desert, a very iconic place again. It really is a very interesting and important part of the topography of Australia. Ever since, of course, Paul and now myself have popularised Lake Eyre, in the press and internationally, I might add. For instance, Qantas Invite magazines and what have you. I'd have people running in from literally from the aeroplane.
When you say Paul, you're talking about Paul Lockyer.
Paul Lockyer, excuse me. Yeah. They'll be flying over the middle of Australia, flicking through the in-flight magazine, seeing one of my pictures, looking down and turning the magazine around and waving at the stewardess saying, is that it? And the stewardess is like going, yes, for the 55th time. Yes, that's the place.
Well, you've got two exhibitions on. They've been on for a while, haven't they?
That's right.
And And people are absolutely fascinated. It's where everyone wants to go, not only Australians, but from all over the world.
Yes, exactly. And interestingly for me, the things that I've learned from actually being present in some of these public venues, and I mean, you know, speaking with literally thousands of people, the thing that came across, which I just wasn't expecting, and especially from the international visitors, was that if you added the cultural importance or significance, I should say, of the Aboriginal peoples, you know, the Arabana people, into the equation, to them it made it all the more worth visiting.
Many, many years ago, I remember one night on the program, me trying to communicate the thrill I'd had in flying for hours and hours and hours over the great vastness of this country, and saying, when I looked out the window, I just saw an immense dot painting. I saw a vast, if you like, series of Aboriginal bark canvases. And that's the truth of it, isn't it?
It's exactly what's been described to me by literally tens of thousands of people. I've had a dollar for every person that says that this looks like a painting, it's an Aboriginal painting, I could retire today. So you're absolutely right. It is a perfect representation. And I think that's why I'm very proud that Aaron and Association have my pictures in their offices in Port Augusta. For me, it's representative of the fact that those pictures are the actual place of their home, their forefathers, you see.
Alan Nell on RN, and we're celebrating Lake Eyre, or Katy Thunder, as it will become known. Joining me, Peter Elfis, photographer whose aerial images of the area are designated fine art by many critics. The perceptive one, Stephen Kenny, the Adelaide lawyer managing the native title claim, and Aaron Stewart, who's the chairperson of the Arabana Association. Aaron, let's pick up on this image, the physicality of it. Let's look down on Finnis Springs Station. It's a stony desert, isn't it? A flat, red, stony desert.
Yes, it's made up of mostly stony desert. There's a few iron ore type rocks there geographically. There's also a plateau where someone carved the what they call then the Maori man in, and then right alongside that, Finnis runs up against the pass point, runs up against Lake Eyre. But just getting back to what you and Peter was talking, I was imagining then, you know, when the early explorers come and when the first explorers found Australia, as in European Captain Cook, etc. They used tools to find it, you know, sailing to navigate their way in. But if you could just imagine looking down from that plane you was in and looking at our country, and you see a large dot painting, if you will, or we never had longitude and latitude to find our ways. And the old thing, what Stephen Kenny was saying with the stories and that, they actually mapped the country.
Of course.
And the geographical features, whether it's an estuary, or a lake, a plateau. But yes, and that was one of the reasons.
Well, in other words, Aboriginal mythology had Googled the entire landscape.
Yeah. But Finnis itself, it's just a small part of our native title claim. It's mostly stony desert. There's a nice big old Gum Creek there, and we're expecting the big old yellow moon to rise up from the east and over the stony desert, reflecting on our, you know, large bonfires that night for our celebrations, and hopefully a few dingoes owling around. And
Aaron, does Finnis have a decent history? Are there aspects of it which were good?
Finnis itself came out of Dunbar Warren, who married an Aboriginal lady and had children. That it was then a pastoral lease, but due to financial matters, when it passed away and management concerns, the minister then stepped in and put it out under the Aboriginal Lands Trust. And I might let Stephen take over from me on the conversation, eh, Steve?
Yes, Stephen, you pick it up. So it's a very important part of the Native Title Agreement, isn't it?
Well, it's a very important part of the Arabana story, because what happened was with Francis Dunbar Warren and his partner, Mr. Woods, who both married two Aboriginal women, and their descendants are all over the country these days, but the whole extended Arabana group came down and lived there, really, in what was a safe haven when many of the other pastoral properties weren't so safe for them. And it became, in the 50s, a place where you know, when the Stolen Generation was happening and they were removing children out of the lands, Francis Dunbar insisted that that not happen there, and they compromised by putting in a mission school, essentially. And yeah, many of the people who are alive today went to that school, and I expect that they will all be back there. So it's really the spiritual heart of the Arabana country, and getting a lease back is a significant thing for the Arabana people.
Of course, your job is far from over, Aaron, because you're going to have to continue to negotiate with other interests in the years and decades to come. You know, you're going to have to interact with the tourism industry. You're going to have to negotiate on other parts of your land with miners and so forth.
Yes, well, the Arabana people at this stage are we're quite willing, arms open to talk to those in industry, miners, and also tourism. If anything, we want our country to be a major draw card, just like anywhere else in Australia, like Kakadu. Although our country, we heard Peter say, can quite change within a few weeks due to the climate. It can be a nice green, lush, flowery desert, and then all of a sudden it could turn back to a red, stony desert. We want to work with the Australian community and the international community, and we really want tourists to come there and enjoy themselves, and also ordinary Australians to see our country for what it is.
With the caveat that you want them to treat it with respect.
Yes, if I could say this with respect, we want to keep the country wild, as in we don't want too much infrastructure. We want people experience Australia for its isolation, for what it is, actually beyond isolation. We want them to experience the outback where, you know, even the silence itself scares you. We want them to experience an Australian. If you go to most touristy places now, they've all got, you know, a lot of infrastructure set up and it's all designed around services, and that's good, but it's not the true Australia.
Well, there's also, in some of these places, there's a problem with what I'd have to say is the Walt Disneyfication of Aboriginal culture.
Yes, yes, yes. You'll find that the Arabana are quite well connected with their culture. Their language is strong, and the elders make stance. They even pull me into gear at times. But yeah, we're pretty, and we do get on good with a lot of the pastoral managers around there. And Stephen, I just received correspondence about a pastoral illu. If you want to ask Stephen about that, that's about working in, not just on Finnis Ring, but going on to country under our native title and stuff like that, yeah.
I want to ask Stephen something else, then that's about the environmental issues that have to be worked on, Stephen. You've got BHP drawing a massive amount of water out of an artesian basin to run Olympic Dam. Roxby Downs are in town. Just tell me of some of the challenges.
That has been a major challenge to the Arabana, and it started with the old Western mining and quite frankly, that in the early days, interference in the affairs of the Arabana people led to an incident in Maree that saw the death of one person and the injury of a number of others, which was a very sad day in a very small town. But hopefully, that will never be repeated in this more enlightened era. But certainly with respect to BHP and the taking of water, it's a massive capacity that they take out. Somebody told me it was sort of equivalent to what we use in Adelaide on a daily basis. So the concern the Arabana have is that their mound springs, which are essentially leaks in the Great Artesian Basin that have...
Oh, this is where they bubble out at the top of mounds, yeah.
The bubbler. Well, yeah. The most famous one is of course called the bubbler because it's essentially a leak from an artesian spring that has collected dirt over thousands of years and is now a 10-meter high hill on the centre of which is a pool of water that had large bubbles that came up and the mud sort of all frothed up. But I was up there last week. And quite frankly, there were there were pretty little bubbles coming out of it. And this is what the people have been saying to me, that the taking of the water is affecting this. Now, there are monitoring bores, and I can't say one way or another, but I'm certainly engaged at the moment with BHP, and we are looking forward to some discussions in the very near future about it.
Well, the fact is that hydrology, the study of bores, groundwater, artesian water, is still incredibly mysterious and not sufficiently understood, and it makes... So you've got to be careful, don't you? Otherwise you can make catastrophic mistakes.
Well, you know, I've been going up to the Barbara for 15 years, and I looked at it last week and went, you know, these guys have been looking at this, you know, submarine for 80 years, and they've all complained to me about it. And I went, I've been here 15 years, and I'm standing out here, and I'm going, this is pathetic. This is nothing like what it used to be 15 years ago. It raises a concern that there has been an impact beyond what we may be officially told, And that's something that Aaron and I are going to be looking at in the weeks and months to come.
Well, let's hope that the big wet will sort of recharge some of the aquifers. Now, Peter, many people have seen, and if not bought and read, that beautiful big Lake Eyre book by Paul Lockyer and colleagues, published posthumously.
Yeah.
And the vast photo that forms the cover of White Saltpan and Blue Sky and little figures trekking across it is your photograph.
That's correct, yes.
Your involvement with the lake started with these ABC blokes.
Yes, that's right.
Tell me about it.
I'm like many people. I saw the report that Paul posted from out there, from the lake, the end of February, May 2009. It ignited something, you know, in me, and you know, sort of leapt out of the sofa really, and ran around waving my arms and said, "That's it, I'm going." You know, I think a lot of people have the same reaction. That's probably, you go out there sometimes and you do that attracts like Pitt Street, you know, in the middle of the night.
Yeah, but you're a good emotional Greek too.
That's right, exactly. So I always have a react about something. I decided that if I wasn't going to do this, then I was literally going to give it up.
Describe it as your Blues Brothers moment.
That's right. Do you see the light? sort of moment. It was incredibly difficult to get out there because at the time all the, you know, the roads were cut off and so I managed to get myself out there. And The first night it was dark, you know, I got in there in the dark, and I'd made, you know, phone calls to arrange to get a helicopter flight, you know, to go up and see the lake, but my way, not just in a sort of a touristy sense, but, you know, do it properly, document it, like, you know, the best way I could.
I've got an old friend, a guy that used to work for me 20, 30 years ago, Bruce Thomas, and Bruce gave me, bless his heart, a photograph taken in the area. It's a huge print, beautiful quality print. I've got framed on the wall. But it happens to be of an inch square. You know, it's like the whole idea of, you know, of chaos theory, you know, where you go down and down and down and down.
Almost a fractal.
The fractal thing. Right. And here's this little tiny one-inch square, which writ large has exactly the same scenic complexity and astonishment. It is wet or dry, one of the most photogenic places on earth.
That's a beautifully put definition, actually, and I'm glad you brought that up because, in fact, an article, a profile that was printed in Australian Art magazine recently, a couple of months ago, was called "Nature in Flux," and it actually went on to describe. It was about myself and this series of photographs on Lake Eyre, and it went on to describe how they are like nature's fractals and so on and so forth, and the, you know, the whole thing about, you know.
I couldn't remember the word fractal. Thank you for that. Yeah.
And that's the other. It's interesting because the only other art that resembles, or at least people have seen this example, is the Aboriginal art. Mm. You know, and so it's kind of ironic that here we are, you know, modernising this concept, but it's existed within the Aboriginal culture for tens of thousands of years, and we're sort of starting to own that as well as sort of like, oh, look what we've just discovered. And they're like, excuse me, we were aware of that a long time ago.
Aaron, I hope you've got some of these of Peter's photographs on the walls of your association's boardroom.
Yeah, actually, I got them in my office where I work, Seneca Family Catholic Services, yes.
Yeah, he's done a good job, hasn't he?
Yes, yes. It's great. He caught the lake mostly in the wet, but it'd be good to get him up there and if he could catch it at different times of the climate. Yes.
Pete, sorry, go back to you, Stephen. It's been a long battle. It's gone on since the white fella first turned up. How far have we got to travel down this road until there really is what Paul Keating would describe, you know, as a legitimate basis for reconciliation?
That's a hard one. And, you know, I've worked with Aboriginal people now for over 30 years, and I still think that we have a long way to go. And sometimes I say to them when I'm talking about native title, and I think native title is in some ways a bit of a disappointment, but that's a longer story. I think in terms of real equality and enlightenment, we've probably got another 50 years to go at least. But can I just take you back to the lake and the interest in the lake as a person who's been into that area on many occasions with Aboriginal people. The lake is just one part of it, and as Aaron will tell you, I mean, there are other places in there of great and complex beauty. And, you know, if your listeners are interested, one of the Arabunna people, Reg Dodd, has for many years run tours there, and he is one of the greatest tour operators I think I've ever run across in terms of allowing people to view a place through the eyes of an Aboriginal person.
Yeah.
So if people are going up there, look up Reg Dodd.
Aaron, it's on May the 22nd. It's going to be extraordinary.
Yes.
And you've already said that after all the politics and the formalities, there'll be people crying there that day. They'll
yes.
be thinking of all those who were lost along the way.
Yeah. When we think of land and I agree what Stephen's previous comments there about native title, it's, you know, we've got a long way to go, but at this particular political stage in the history of Australia, it's the best us as a people can receive from a society that is still evolutionising itself, coming to terms of which I call a young country, being Australia in Western or European eyes. The stage up at Finnis, it will be sombre and it will be very spiritual, I believe, because of the great loss of death and all the hurt, not just from non-Aboriginal people, but also Aboriginal people. It's about accepting what has happened and accepting change and relying on forgiveness, you know, on the person standing next to you on the day, or accepting the person in front of you or behind you for all their differences as just being human beings.
Aaron, you're a very eloquent fella. You really are. That's your words are as good as Peter's photographs, and I thank the three of you for your time. I've been talking to Aaron Stewart, the chairperson of the Ururaka Arabunna Association, to Stephen Kenny, the association's lawyer, and to the passionate Greek-Australian photographer Peter Alphus. His exhibition, being held over two venues, runs until the 12th of July. That's at Customs House in Sydney, a fine building, and until the 13th of May at the Mayor Gallery in Waterloo in Sydney. We'll put the details of those in Peter's website on ours at abc.net.au/radionational. Now, on our next, I'll be telling you about the complicated and secret life of Leonard Jolly and his second wife, Australian writer Elizabeth Jolly, who I got to know quite well. And I'll be talking to Elizabeth's stepdaughter, Susan Swingler. And it's not a happy story. Stay tuned now to RN, and we will see you later.